G'day and welcome. This is the testing, the power of testing tutorial. There was homework for this. It is on the Wiki website, all the homework. You should have done that before you came. First of all, we have Peter Miller, Urban Geek number one, Eric, Urban Geek number two, and Rob, Urban Geek number three. All three have extensive software experience, and I've learned a hell of a lot by talking to them at various times. Thank you, gentlemen. Away you go. So we've got a paper we've put together, which is being presented tomorrow. We'll do it our way. Do you want to relate your quote, Eric?
Ah, yes. I was working with a fellow who was writing all this code in C, and he had this ad hoc testing. So he'd write this new module, and then he'd modify the module that pumps data into a new module, run through a few times, look at stuff in memory to see if it was all the small embedded system. So he'd actually look at stuff in memory, and then say, oh yeah, that looks right. Then he'd revert the changes back in the module that he'd modified to provide data for it, and that was the end of his testing. And I said, look, this doesn't work. And he said, well, you know, I've been doing this way for years, it worked for me. And I said, I've tried it your way, I think it's time for you to try it my way. He said, no, it'll slow me down. I then spent, on the request of my manager, spent 5 weeks writing tests for his stuff. And the first 2 weeks, I was logging about 15 bugs a day into the bug tracker. He eventually came along around to the idea of testing, but only if I was doing his testing. That's another story.
So, what we're trying to do in this tutorial is to teach four of the principles, the specific techniques we've identified in our paper, which is being presented tomorrow. And we hope that they will either be really easy and natural to you, in which case we'll rejoice because there'll be more people doing testing and better software for us to use. Or there'll be something new or a modification of what you're doing and you'll find it useful and be able to take it away and use it. Due to time constraints and some disciplining information on exactly how hard it will be for you to pick up and run with these techniques, we've only got four on today. If we get through some subset, that's also okay. So let's get on with it. So the first technique, it's a fairly obvious one. If you've got, sorry, this question?
It's a stupid question, but I'm vaguely coming to the same file, but how do you find it?
It was just a really simple.
It was just like on cow.
Yeah.
Cow. Yeah, nothing more than that. But you probably know more about how. If there isn't some such a thing as how, you probably know more about
how. We just know there was a word called how.
In Chinese, means good.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
I think so, that's fantastic. That really is. So, I mean, it's fairly obvious. If you've got a very large amount of work to do, you have to start somewhere, and you may as well start with the smallest thing that you can do, and then build up, and you build up a larger set. So, to do this, as it says on the board, just write something small. Write some larger tests that test combined functionality, and at the end of the process, you want to have a smoke test that just makes sure the whole thing fits together smoothly. And by writing about some number of tests with granularity, what we mean is that if you have, say, four components right down at the gut, each component might get 10 tests. And then when you combine them together, you just do 10 tests of the combination. You don't need to do 40 tests at that combining level. And if you have one single sort of smoke test that's testing the entire stack of what you're doing, you don't need to do another 40 tests at that level. You only need to do 10 or so for each identifiable thing you're testing. And if you're testing the combination, there's 10 tests on combining. If you're testing end-to-end, there's 10 tests on end-to-end. 10
to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end. 10 to end
Yeah. So do food tech. So I can So what we've got here as an example is libGMP, which has some internal structures that aren't very visible, but can be useful in testing, and we want to write a little tool to dump out the content of those. And that your homework is preparing yourself to do that easily. The second technique, which combines with this, the first one quite usefully in the scenario we've got, is what we call placeholder resolve. We're also calling it you'll know it when you see it. And the idea here is that rather than mentally simulating some potentially very complex process, or doing it on a piece of paper until you've figured out everything about what this result should look like, it's often much easier, if you imagine a paths graph or this layout, to do the thing and to inspect what you get out. As a human, you can say, yes, that's what I expected. It's correct. Take the result that was spat out by your program and put it into your test as the expected result. Actually, I should probably do that. You guys all know the basis of testing, that you have a scenario which has a setup, an expected result, and you run your code and you should get an actual result, and then you compare them. If they're the same, your test is passed. If they're not the same, your test is failed. Well, you all do now, so that's good news.
And quite often you might have things like, you know, internal data structures in whatever you think, and, you know, how do you compare before and after? Well, dump the text, and then you can diff. You know, once you've got that text output, you can then diff expected results versus what you're actually dumping out of your program or the module you're testing.
So this particular approach is simply one that says, rather than spending a lot of time doing what you want the computer to do, you have to do it and then check it, did it right. Again, this stuff is pretty...
Sometimes you have your test set and it sort of evolves, and then, like, you know, you have a test set and you'll find X amount of things in your test set, and there's going to be problems with them, and then, you know, you're going to change your test set to add other test conditions, and then all of a sudden they're fixed, and so all your tests start failing if they're aware of...
Yep, you'll definitely want to come and see the paper tomorrow.
Yeah, I did exactly the thing on what was basically a compiler, and the test inputs and outputs were constantly changing, and with the sort of graphic techniques I was using, it was very easy to keep the whole thing up to date, and only check using things like graphical diff tools, it was possible to only check the bits that have changed and saying, is that right, commit both the, and then commit to the revision control, both the new expected result and the way we go to the next test.
So there's also things you can do in terms of isolation there. If you're changing your test set each time you've got n results that have been checked against one test input, perhaps you actually need n test inputs, and that way you won't be interacting with them all. So this is the first example. The idea here is that you guys sit down and do it when you've got questions. There are three of us who all know what one form of this looks like as finished code, and we can wander around and talk to you. And it is a tutorial, so we're expecting everyone to be talking with each other about this, rather than us standing up at front and saying, okay, time starts now, let's see
what you can do.
Yeah. So when you've applied that patch, you'll have a test mpf-dump.c file in the source code for GMP. You can run this in the test suite by doing make check. If you cd down into that directory and do make check, it will complete a lot faster. And the goal here is use these first two techniques. Start small and build up, and placeholder result to build a MPFT, which is a floating point type structured number. So we should be able to give a char star out that represents one of these things in an unambiguous, clear, and easy to read manner. Any questions at this point? What we've provided is the test machinery so that you have a test script that can run and it's got the initial setup code and teardown code that the GMP test environment needs, and we have not provided the dumper. So you're providing the dumper and you're providing the test at the same time. Because the dumper is actually a small amount of code. Again, time constraints, we can't really give something that's testing 10 or 20 real independent modules in an hour and a half shoot. the amount of code you should be expecting to get in, including the S and the C, is around about 40 or 50 lines tops. So it should be nice and self-contained. Check underscore dump is the point where you can start writing a test, and clearly at C it should be easy to add more tests if you want more and more things to test. There's a little bit more stuff I forgot to mention. There's an assert string function in, sorry, assert always is a defined function inside GMP which will compare a condition and exit the test script if the condition isn't met. So in capital, the third underscore always open bracket and just like you do in this statement, whatever you want in there, in bracket, semicolon. And that's the basis on which they build the text.
Well, I'll do it.
Online, the GMP documentation is pretty comprehensive and it's got all the MPS functions. I'll dig up your URL for you.
The reason that we're putting the terminal structure into a stream is not functionally good. We would anticipate using it numerous times.
There were two things I did when I was putting this together that I thought would make life easier for me. The first one, can you read that? We know what's got there is my easement configure. How do we do this? First thing I thought would be really useful because I want to be able to compare the output easily. It's the easiest way to do that is if I have the string. So I added a macro to assert, using assert always to show me the actual difference between the strings. But this little macro, assert string always, is something you might want to just grab. All it's doing is doing a string comp, and if there is a difference, it prints that out, and then it goes through to the there's always macro that the GMP, the other GMP tests use. And that made it quite easy for me to write this first test here, which is testing the content of, or the printing out, just the limbs themselves. So within the MPS data structure, which is defined in GMP.h, you've got a set of limbs, and there's one more limb than there is the size of the data structure, which is the next level of complexity. So this is just the absolute internals. I wanted to make sure they could print out properly. So MPST is a C struct. The init set string initializes the from string, which has got an antecedent and exponent in the base. I call the function, I've written to, I think that was the right thing to dump the float out. And I just have, this is the result I wanted. And then I assert that it turned out a good result. Now, different versions of GMP actually have quite different internals, so you make a very different result on your specific machine. But it will be the same result every time that you're on the code. And then I free the temporary variable I grabbed. I'll cheat it a little bit here and put in two tests in a row, so I want to make sure it wasn't a fluke and I wasn't just reading something from the stack or something silly like that. now. Let me dig up that URL because the details for how infrastructure is actually quite useful.
Your calling a function that does have just min.
Yeah, that's the little loop I wrote.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I hope you don't mind your history being on the list.
You can see clothes on that.
Let me see. Google, I want an MPFC MPF in a set string. Manual, GNU MP. How about that? Alright. Probably the best place to start. Oh, okay, we're losing the
handbook.
Oh, there's just a URL, maybe you can probably, have type copy and paste on the screen. I just put it for NPS underscore key. And then MPS underscore init underscore set underscore is here. So, looking at this line, we probably want to move a little bit to the forward. How about I just walk through this one? So unless there's a bunch of objectives, what I'm going to do is to just walk you through the resulting code and how it was built up. No one's objecting. Okay. So the very first thing I did is I wrote this NPF min number, which is one you've just been looking at, which just takes two floating point numbers and tries to dump their limbs only to make sure that I've got that bit working. I did this because the structure of NPFT is that it has three ends. The precision, the size, and the exponent, and then it has a variable amount of data in the limb. It's an array of an internal data type. Now these numbers all happen to have four, but if you get very big numbers, they add limbs as needed. So the actual code to do that then is also fairly small in that there's always going to be one limb there because the number of limbs is one plus the size in the MPFT field. Size is the precision count. So what I had to do is just write a loop that will execute at least once and put these into a string. So I just use ASSINDEP, which I don't know if it's a common standard or a remote extension, but it has a nice property that allocates the string for me, so I didn't need to worry about buffer overflows or other stuff. And even for sample code, I can't object to doing it wrong. So it loops around, and each time it just appends the decimal representation of the limb to this set, which is the line here. This is test code itself, passed the test suite before I'm writing it, so I want to know if this function fails, I want it to bail out, and so I use the assert always function from the test suite to check the result code of every function I call. If test was free, it's free fail, but I don't really want to know about it. Any questions on that? It all makes sense.
I'm really happy that the test suite actually checked the all memory is free.
Yes.
At the end of it, and actually pulled the value for me. That's just something amazing.
One of the things we talk about in the paper is test infrastructure should really aid you in making sure your code is correct. And the GMP test suite is very nice.
And the more advanced the test is, the better it's going to be catching unintentional slip-ups.
So having successfully, I can make this a little wider, I think.
You said that you were cheating before when you used the same function to test a couple of things.
makes your 10 feet less flexible, and the less flexible, the harder it is to change the code of testing. So over time, that becomes more and more difficult to work with. And I mean, it's a habit I've got into. I think both me and Eric, I think me, Eric, and Peter have all got into it, is not doing that.
So
what you need is some functions which will do the setup of the state you need very, very quickly. And because they know about the internals and how your system works, even if you are actually with the database, and they can do things like dropping an exact representation of the database in place. There are ways you can balance these two things. That's another way of saying that you've got the same situation. Well, you were talking about efficiency before. It's not really efficient to do a bunch of assertions without relevant to the test you're trying to execute. You only want to check any one assertion once, unless it's a very, very, very cheap assertion like the usual function check. So, no, I wouldn't do that. It will still be hard to modify. If you need to go to one of these underlying tests and change it, because you're changing the API of your program, you're going to break all your other tests. And
the other thing that's important to remember is that, unlike the human, the computer doesn't get bored. The test suite takes a little bit longer. I don't have a problem with that. It doesn't get bored. I do. I don't run manual tests. I'm a bad at them. I get bored. I go, stuff like this. Right? The computer doesn't get bored. We don't have enough topics. The smoke test should be quick. It should be a representative set of tests that you can run easily and often. And then you can run the entire test suite and so on.
Notwithstanding that, as a data point, the BZR test suite's got 4,500 tests that take 5 minutes to run. That's the entire regression test suite. And it's doing version control, just about every single test is working heavily on this. It's possible to make these things fast. I think you need to ask yourself, what is more valuable, the correctness and flexibility of your code, or the time it takes to run the test? It's not an easy answer, but you have to understand that you are making a trade-off when you let those two things interfere with each other. So this was the second test, building up slightly more functionality this time. This test is using the function we've already tested and the full dump function, and it's trying to get the complete structure dumped out. So MPS precision 3, size 1, exponent 1, and whatever the limbs are in square brackets. I thought this was a reasonably easy way to make it clear what I was seeing on screen if the test failed. And again, because of the test suite here, I have to free things of allocators, but the assertion just uses the string difference. And this is where the placeholder value comes in. When I was writing this test, the way I did it, and that's what obviously our theory on how the tutorial might work well wasn't quite right. But the way I wrote the test is I started with a result of that. In fact, I started with not valid. And then I ran it. And it came back with that. And I said, okay, that looks good to me, because I don't know anything about how GMP's internals work, but the limb dumping I'm sure of from the previous one, and the precision size and exponent I dropped into GDB, and it was printing out the values that were in the structure. I just said, I don't know enough about GMP to say whether it was the right value, but it's certainly accurately reflecting the internals. And so I did the same thing here. For the non-zero result, I wanted another data point to make sure I wasn't printing the wrong of memory. If I'm printing out part of the code, it's not going to vary every time, but it's also not going to be the correct thing. The functions for these are actually very simple. The dump MPS function just starts with the limbs as a variable, and then there's a string format of the int and the limbs with a square bracket around it. That's here. So it's now 11:43, so we're about halfway through. Is it like a 5 minute break, stretch legs, anything like that?
I mean, break down this question. I think about that.
Nope, okay, that's easy. put your hand up if you're listening. Alright. Okay. So the next two techniques are somewhat larger, so we're going to do them one at a time. From the tutorial page, there's a Venus, tar.bz, and a couple of extra files to download. Probably I will just walk through it bit by bit rather than speaking sort of something you can work through. Although it may be easier in this case, I don't know really. So dividing something into code, the idea is, and we've got a space constraint here, that's why we've got the separate paper, we've gone into a whole bunch more detail. The idea is though that when you're testing things that have external dependencies, and this can come in a whole bunch of shapes, it can be things that are outside your control, like the actual internet, DNS server, NSS server. Or it can be things that are within your control, but they're very expensive, like databases, large amounts of random data. Don't use them. Find or create, if it doesn't exist, enough modularity in your code that you can replace those resources when the test is run. And you can, in fact, replace them with different things for every single test instance you've got, if that makes sense for your problem. By doing this, you reduce the dependencies between the test you're running and other parts of the code base or other unrelated things, which means that your test is more repeatable, got better isolation, and usually it becomes a lot faster. So the example we had here is Venus, which is a branch of Planet. So you've seen planet.linux.conf.au, that's the output of this program. And we wanted to run a test for it that would check it actually goes off to an HTTP server and pulls down the feed and then formats and writes it to the local page. Now obviously it does do that because Planet works today. I'm not out to find bugs. What it's out to do is to demonstrate how we can actually use the code that thinks it's talking to an HTTP server without having to have one. So I need to copy around files again. Give me enough government. If you want to, you can look at the test _vhc.py file, which has a full test with their versions. The only thing missing is that it will fail at the moment, because there is no web server at example.com with the RSS feed looking for. And so that's the thing that it's hard to write this test. If we do it by hand, we have to bring up a real web server. But there's a very, very, very small way of bringing up a sample data that will just work.
And the point of the name of this technique is that instead of trying to test all of the code one, particularly if you're suddenly lumped with an enormous checkbook legacy piece of code, is you can do it a piece at a time, find a sensible piece, and subdivide your problem. It's very often the case that a legacy piece of code will have no test, and you want to make a modification. The first thing you have to do is add some tests and make sure you don't break anything. But what do you add? How do you add it? Where do you add it? Because you've got this thing with snakes for hair and you have no idea which is where. Start small. Break it up into pieces as logical as you can find and deal with small pieces. Subdivide the code. If there's an interface that you want to check crossing, replace one half of that interface. So then testing and some other guy, whatever that is. That's what we mean. Divide the code based off these small pieces.
So who's got Venus? Who's done the download of these things? Great. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'll walk through the process of identifying where the modularity is in this case and hooking it in. So the first thing is make sure that when you run, you should be able to run .runtest.py at the top of that, and we'll run off a bunch of tests. And we'll expect to get one failure. We may get another. I think the branch Venus I downloaded is slightly broken. But we should get a failure in test firing. Do you want me to put on the mark?
There is no mark?
There is no mark?
Oh,
that's easy. Yeah, well,
get the mic.
Get the mic.
Sure.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. So if you look at test firing, example, one I've got here is slightly different because I've done the substitution, but it calls off from quite a planet, and somewhere in there, the value you get should be down at this line here, where it's going to say, look, I couldn't find the solids you're looking for, there's only a couple there. So it's obviously gone and done something, but it hasn't successfully pulled down the data. So what I did to debug this is I added a PDB statement before the spider call, which dropped me into the debugger. So I can step into that and I can walk through and see where it starts doing HTTP stuff. Another way of doing it would have been to do things like tracking for HTTP or for URL or other such things in the code base, because I don't know the code base at all. Now, having done that, do you have the demo customer? Have you pulled down? Where is it?
/FN.
What I'm doing this now is just setting up those refactors. I can actually show you this slide. So I should be able to do one step at a time now. For me, I expect this to pass. So I'll just continue. That passed. Now, I remove my hook where I'm inserting my module and run this. It should now fail. Good. Wrong number of files. This is the failure you should be seeing right now. So I'll run it, and this time I'll step into it. And it's not a small function that steps into, which is a bit frustrating. So I can look at the code, and I can see it's doing some pocket stuff, it's setting up some multiple threads. Okay, it's got a comment here that for each thing that's been subscribed to, it's going to go off and do it. And when I look at that, the only thing I can really see is it puts it on queue, and then it gets back queue results, and then tries to pass stuff and goes off in this bright cache, but it doesn't seem obvious to me about where it's actually going and doing things. However, write cache is taking data blocks, so possibly that's a good thing to look at. Another possibility is the speed path of that path, maybe going off and doing the connection and getting what's going on. So I'm going to drop out the debug and just have a quick snip around the code. So I'll start with the speed table because we are dealing with speed here. And taking a URL in, and this line looks very interesting. That looks to me like a place where it's going off and actually going to be talking to URL file stream or string, the pretty good variable name there. So if I want to change the behavior of Spider Planet, I need to change the behavior of Open Resource. So I might need to go deeper into Open Resource. I don't know enough about the code base yet. So let's have a look at Open Resource. Open Resource takes any input source and deals with a uniform manner that just gives you a stream back that's got read, readline, readline, and close. That looks like something I can modify really easily. So, in terms of languages, there are a number of different ways you can hook in alternative code paths. in C, C++, or other compiled languages, you can have an alternative object file you link with that supplies the replacing interface. So you can just build however much code is needed, and each of test suites will link in this test run source file instead of or before the alternative. If you're replacing something that's in the library, like if you're replacing the actual real public connect and select call, which is a reasonable thing to do in some situations, then you just need another library that you put on the link line before the standard one. If you are working in a language like Ruby or Perl or Python, what you can do is at runtime change the environment so that it calls your code instead of calling the normal system library calls for that. And this lets you do it in a very dynamic manner and in a very quick and efficient manner. You don't need to change large amounts of infrastructure to be able to do this. So if I go back to our test suite here, what I want is I want a function which will take the same parameters as open the door, but will actually get back just the test data I need. So I'm going to create a sub-open function which, as you can see, URL file, single string, etag, agent, referrer, handlers. And I'm going to return a string IO, which is just a string that can be treated like a file, the standard Python facility. The feed data I've put here is just enough feed data to trigger a couple of files on this. And all I need to do in my test is save the old function, so I can put it back when my test is finished, and replace it with my new function. Doing this, like so, will let the test complete. So the point about this is that the entire difference between the sample test file you've got on your disk and the one here, except for the extra test data that I'm getting from somewhere, I just claim all knowledge of the rest of the code base, is that I've got to try finally around the test. So this bit here, this is the test you've got. And these three lines and these two lines substitute my little test sub-open, which is the one-line function that's preloaded menu because it's got literal data in it for the existing function. And this is the point of technique. You can take something that's conceptually very hard to do because it's got lots of moving parts. I mean, bringing up an entire web server is possible. Another way of writing a test is to set up a web server, give it some of the data, wait to make sure it's listening on the socket, and then run this with the URL. There's, you know, localhost 480. So I'm going to have to be a privileged user, / example C. And that would work. Except it's going to be about 50 or 60 times slower because I'm bringing up a full web server. And they take a certain amount of time just to do socket, bind, wait, read data from disk, return it back to you. This operates entirely in memory. Now, one of the things you need to do, which we don't demonstrate here, is that if you replace an interface like this, your test is going on testing the real code. So you need to make sure that the interface you're given, so the substitute one and the real one, don't vary. And there are a number of ways of doing that. You can have a validator, which you run against the real interface and against your one. And in this case, the validator would be, have I got something I can do read on, read line on, read line, and close? Because that's the contract. And I need to be able to give it these parameters. On the real one, you might give it a file on this, and on the sample one, we not have enough to ignore everything and hand it back, but that's okay, because we'll be able to tell if someone goes to real code and changes the interface in the future, this test that tests the two interfaces will break, and you'll know that something's gone wrong. Questions? Please,
that could
be questions.
There's no appeal to doing the open resource in the setup container.
Right.
Just so you don't have to do the try binding.
Yeah, that's absolutely good. I was trying to demonstrate with the minimum number of assumptions about knowledge of the Python testing environment.
Okay.
The PyUnit testing environment has the ability to run code before and after your test underscore function executes. This is a setup and teardown. And this lets you factor out things that should always run before and always run after, so that you don't have to ensure they run by using try finally, and you can avoid having these individual tests. It's a place to put common setup on.
And the other comment I had was that I wasn't resolved to find a lot of funky, internal, undocumented implementation details that you were modifying.
Yep.
Do you consider that a black box test? Exactly. Do you consider that a bad thing at all?
Well, we're testing implementation.
So I think I'm just testing implementation of OpenResource. We're testing the other thing. It's the whole provider function thing.
Yeah.
We're not testing OpenResource. We're testing another one. We're pretty confident that both pieces work, then we might try testing the two together.
No, I was just talking about it's the implementation is only one time in the test.
Okay.
What does test fail there if they change the implementation to be completely correct but not used?
Exactly. Yeah, so if they change things, then I think that your question there, which is about what happens if they change something so that it's still correct and our test fails, because we don't have as much isolation as we'd like. If they change it to not call open the door, they're changing the structure of their code, they're changing the structure of the module. And this is a test that's testing that module. It is coupled to that structure. If we were testing something further out, I told the line there, this isn't meant to test speed parts, this is meant to test. So the problem here is that the right way to do this is to hand in to the spider module an implementation of interface and to have that propagate down so that the contract isn't being violated. That's somewhat longer to demonstrate. Ideally, the interface there that was passed in would be feed passed. Which would say, okay, what these parts of the spider panel want to use, and here's one that happens to know that it doesn't need to go off and do anything anywhere else for the memory.
I'll make a point that I've got a situation in the past where you've got a whole bunch of text on code, and you want to change the code, and that's a simple one, but you can't change the code because the test is coupled with the specific implementation of it. And this is an example of that.
What I've found is that as you introduce more and more testing into the code becomes more modular, so that it is forcing you to become more structured in your code as a whole.
Yeah, but
you'll
have
to
take
yourself
about changing the API there,
another angle on it too, which is that if you want to change the API, you're going to break all the clients anyway.
Yeah, but this is a private function.
I've already acknowledged that this isn't an ideal example of it. This would aim to be the...
If you think of the public function, then that's where I think you would make an example of you start documenting the API, because you're in a sense saying, this is my API and this is how it's supposed to be using. If you go and change the prototype, then this has to be well.
So the way to write this in such a way that you're using a public function is instead of replacing planet.feedpath with open resource here, you could say old parser equals planet.feedpath dot testing parser, for example. So if you did that, and we replace the entire feed part module, that substitutes out what is possibly more stable interface. But that are bigger in space, and I didn't really know what the idea of say, hey guys, right in time, be part of this, even if just a demo one. It's got, I think, three or four functions that you need to figure out. But aren't as obvious as just, hey, hand back the screen.
If you inherit from the original model, it's not the part. You need an abstract interface so that you can, and you can inherit from that and make a concrete real one and a concrete existing one. But for testing purposes, if you inherit from a concrete part, you are not isolated from changing to the concrete part that aren't changing the interface.
If you want to just be able to replace an interface, you have to be just up at the point of
This is a point which comes up again and again, and that is that if you're really keen on testing, if you're determined to do testing, your code will actually modify over time to become more testable. But you've got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you start where you can, you go, you know, that's really ugly. Let's refactor a couple of things so that it's not ugly.
So
but you've got to test, and when you refactor, it doesn't break, right? Well, because you've got to test, you know what it's supposed to do, you can refactor with a great deal more confidence.
So, I mean, as a data point here, we had to do a whole bunch of tests up here that I just picked up from the existing kind of test suite, which, you know, we're changing global variables on both of these. We're making directories on this. We're changing other global variables if something got low. I wasn't terribly worried about using an internal function when I'm already changing global state and going to affect the rest of the test suite. I think there's a balance. When you're introducing a test into a clean environment, you can afford to be much cleaner about it. When you're introducing a test into an environment that's not as clean, then you're not going to get as much return just going to be able to make it clean because you're going to supply back a whole bunch of other constraints. And we don't do testing because we want tests. We do testing because we want high quality software. So the focus has to be, what return am I getting for this parameter? I mean, if you enjoy writing tests for the sake of writing tests, fantastic.
Hey, I've got a project for you.
I think we all do.
So that's the technique. So on to the next one. I'll tip the final talk again more, because we've got about four times as many techniques to cover. It's significantly deeper, but it's not going into code examples at all. It's all just theoretical.
And particularly the paper, which we've done as well.
Yes. The paper is the big thing. So, one of the patterns, this is actually the pattern you asked about earlier. Why do I think it's bad? Why do we think it's bad to do multiple different versions in one test? Well, it's not so much doing multiple assertions in one test. It's doing some setup, doing an assertion, doing some more setup, doing another assertion, doing some more setup, doing another assertion. This makes tests less clear. It's not clear what the focus is on that test because you're actually doing three or four or five sets of setup in the first place. Secondly, it becomes very hard to modify once you do this more than a very small amount, because if you want to change one of the earlier tests in that series of tests that have been done with one big one, you are more than likely going to throw out and cause damage to the later assertion. They're no longer going to have the right numbers. If they're looking at, for example, log output, there's going to be different noise at the beginning of the log you're going to have to filter out, and you end up fighting with it. It's much nicer to have. I'm testing this thing, it comes up, it runs, and it goes down. And not unrelated to this, if you have a series of, essentially, they should be independent assertions going on, and one of the early ones fails for some reason, the later ones may fail as well, but you'll never know, because it won't reach it. Whereas if they have a separate test coming up in parallel, your test suite will run each of them and report that you get three or four or five or however many different failures. So you get better diagnostics by having more than a pair of tests. And this is a fairly mechanical process. If you've got a test that's larger than it should be, just take a copy of it. Find the first assertions in it. In the copy, delete everything under those assertions. That's all part of another test. go back to the original, find those first assertions that are now safely duplicated over there, and delete them. They're not metas, they're not part of the test anymore. You've shrunk the test. You've probably got some duplicate code at the top. Factor that out into a common helper function. Parameterize that as needed, you know, the code may not be entirely identical. And you may find that not only do you have duplicate code, you have duplicate effort, that you're redoing things in the first test that you don't need to do quite at all, that you can just completely shrink down or eliminate. And keep repeating this until you've got a whole bunch of separate tests that do one test each. You look like you're about to ask a question. No?
The anti-patterns that is particularly irksome to me as a project leader is the person who wants to write this mammoth test that takes an hour to run, and it took him days to write, and he wants to do one commit of a month's worth of code. And project manager, I infinitely prefer that they do a snootload of smaller commits, and that means that he takes his enormous test and commits a portion of the test corresponding to the code he's got working today. For whatever granularity you need as a project lead, we want to give them a way to commit every day or every 2 days or not less than once a week.
Some of this will surprise them.
Eric commits about 20 times a day. It might be more than I do, but...
A good version control system can help, but we're not doing that sort of right now.
Don't look disappointed.
I
should have much more
So, in the Venice source code, there is a test file there called testscrub.py. And in actual fact, the Venice tests are in pretty good shape in this regard. They all pretty much test a single thing. But testscrub future in that testscrub.py actually tests three different things. Do one thing, do some changes, do another, do some changes, do another, do some changes. And it's not entirely clear what scenarios it's trying to test. So this one's so easy, I'm just going to do it on the fly. Definition would be great. Do you know how to do the ignition or not?
No.
Clearly,
you can get instructions
back to written
with that one
instruction. So you meant to hold it for 10 seconds or not?
Hold.
If this hold is going to
close it.
5, 7, 3.
One elephant.
Two elephants. So here's the test that I'm going to use as our example here. It's not a terribly long test. Again, we had this whole tension between the amount of time in the tutorial and the amount of time that you actually need to spend to get hold of the idea and run with it. So if you look at this test, what does this actually test? Not entirely clear to me, looking at that code, whether it's doing one test, two tests, or three different tests, or are these just insertions on the way to make sure that the test data is valid, which is one actual reason to have multiple assertions at the beginning of a test. So I'm just going to...
When I do, like, the building interface preparation,
right, or you know, check no one change the sample. Right. So I think that actually what the first two things are doing is they're saying, look, by default, the sample data should have one entry and it should be set to updated so it looks like something that's going to change. Because it wants to test with a known set of good samples.